All this is Dr. Mobeen Sayed from drmobeen.com. Welcome to one more show. Today we have a star with us once more. We have Dr. Paul Marek. He's the author of the Math Plus Protocol, celebrated, decorated professor, doctor, and he is heading the ICU unit as well for the East Virginia Medical School. So Dr. Paul Marek is within the Department of Internal Medicine, and he is Chief Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine Head. So, Dr. Marek, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. King Bean.
Thank you very much. So, I was discussing with you before that you are the most favorite personality of the Cool Beans. So, thank you for your work, and thank you for the education that you are giving us.
And thank you to the Cool Beans, the String Beans.
You are very, very welcome. Thank you for coming in. So for the today's discussion, what I wanted to start with is the, so for the Cool Beans, today we are going to talk about number one, COVID-19 management, number two, masks, and most importantly, we are going to talk about what Dr. Marek calls post-COVID syndrome and what we have been calling long haulers. So please stick around for the long hauler discussion, because that is really important. And that is what is the Math Plus Protocol revision in September 2 as well. So we'll discuss that. So Dr. Marek, all yours. So we have here on the screen target ACE2 on type 2 pneumocyte. And you were mentioning it is really important for all the healthcare professionals to understand that the viral phase versus the immune phase are different. So can you shed some light? Can you tell us how to look at it, this disease?
So thank you, Dr. Bean. So what I think the focus today should be on timing. And I don't think folks understand the timing. You listen to the experts, you listen to people talking, and I don't think they realize how important timing is in terms of treatment. Could you go back to the slide before, the next one? Yeah, that slide. So this is such an important slide, and you'll see how it fits in. Mm-hmm. So basically, so maybe you're right. Maybe go back to the other slide you were on.
This one?
Yes, that's the one. Mm-hmm. So basically what happens is you get exposed to the virus, and as we'll see, this is a highly contagious virus. Mm-hmm. Then have the incubation phase lasts about 5 days. Now, this thing goes into the symptomatic phase where patients have fever, malaise, cough, and whatever. This lasts about 8 days. And then, as you'll see, the virus stops replicating. And we'll come to this because you have no active viral replication. You then go into the symptomatic pulmonary phase and the late pulmonary phase. Now, the point about this is, you have profound immune dysregulation. And this is not due to viral replication or viral cytopathic effect. This is such an important concept. The immune dysregulation is a result of the host response to dead virus. The viruses are dead, and the host is responding to these dead viral fragments. So that's why the distinction between the symptomatic phase where the virus is actively replicating, then at about 8 days after symptoms, the host immune response, probably through cytotoxic T cells, the virus is dead. But patients still remain PCR positive. Now, if we go to the previous slide number, which we were looking at, yes. So basically what this does is looks at the PCR and looks at live virus by culture. So the crosses are PCR, and it's on a log scale. So you can see that initially the first 10 days, the PCR, the viral load is exceedingly high. We're talking about 10 to the 10 virons. So that's a billion. A billion viruses per milliliter. So there's an enormous viral load. The dark circles reflect those patients that have viral culture positive. So you will see patients only have positive virus culture up until day eight. Past day eight, all the viruses are dead. What you're picking up on the PCR is you're picking up dead viruses. You're picking up RNA fragments. So the fact that the PCR is positive does not mean the patients have living replicating virus. What you're picking up is RNA fragments from all the gazillion dead viruses. So this becomes really important, because if you think about it, giving an antiviral drug when you have dead virus doesn't make sense, because once the virus is dead, it's dead. You can't kill something that's dead. It's dead. So giving antiviral therapy after day 8 to 10 of symptoms is completely dumb. The same thing happens with convalescent serum. In giving antibodies to kill a virus that's dead is just not going to work. So it's absolutely critical to understand that antiviral therapies only work in the first 8 to 10 days of symptoms. And thereafter, they have minimal effect. The symptomatic phase, which is the profound inflammatory response, is the host's response to this enormous burden of dead viral debris. So it's viral RNA and proteins that the host mounts a profound inflammatory response. So you go from a phase where you have viral replication, where you maybe want to kill the virus, to a phase where you want to dampen the immune response. And that distinction is just so important, because the treatment approach is completely different. You can go to the next slide.
So just a comment over here then, and that is, when I see many of my friends, colleagues, other healthcare workers in the ICU, maybe day 20, day 30, still trying to give remdesivirs or still trying to give antivirals, that would not then work really, because there is no virus.
You know, if you think about it, it's completely and utterly dumb. And that's the point that I'm trying to get to, is that I can't tell you how many thousands of people in the ICU are getting remdesivir. And as I'll show you, their own data tells us it doesn't work. And just by pure logic, we know it's not going to work, because all the viruses are dead. And it's impossible to kill something that's dead, Dr. Bean.
I think so, yes.
This is another slide. Again, this is, I think, from Nature, showing again exactly the same thing. The red dots are positive viral culture. So you can see the virus can only be cultured up until the 10th day, whereas the PCR remains positive for a profound period of time. So the fact that you PCR positive does not mean you have live replicating virus. It's a very important point.
That is such a great thing. So that means that when we are trying to give remdesivir in this kind of an area, we are really trying to kill the PCR itself, not the virus, because the virus itself is already dead.
Exactly. You're treating dead virus. And, you know, Gilead doesn't want you to know this, because they want you to use as much remdesivir as you can use. But it's completely wasted. And you'll see the next slide again confirms this. This is a really interesting study. What they did in Taiwan is they took people who were COVID positive. They then traced all of their contacts to see what days the contacts became, or contact with the index case, what day they became infective. And your patients were only infective or transmitted the disease up until day 5 or 6, which fits in with what I've told you. So once you have, you know, in the asymptomatic phase, you can see people are infectious. So these asymptomatic people, and in the incubation period is when you're infectious. But after day 5, You don't have active virus, so you're no longer infectious, which again confirms what I've just told you, that after about day five, the load of viable replicating virus is much lower and you can't transmit the disease.
Got it.
So it's such an important concept because you have the first phase of viral replication. The virus then stops replicating, and then the inflammation is due to the dead virus. And if you think about it, there are trillions and trillions of dead virus with trillions of all this debris of RNA, and the host is responding. The macrophages and T cells are responding to all this viral debris, and that's what's causing this profound inflammatory response.
Very interesting.
It's truly interesting and truly astonishing. So it's not, you know, it's not actually the virus which is killing the host or killing the lung. And we know this from autopsy studies. There's very little direct cytopathic effects.
So let me ask you a question then. We still see people who are, let's say, Math Plus is being used. We are still seeing people dying. Of course, the rate is less. Of course, the number of people dying is less. What is it a timing issue or is it the comorbidities? What is it that there are still some people, unfortunately, who become a victim?
Yes, so that is a good question. So maybe let's go through the next slides and then we'll talk about that. So this is basically, you know, basically what I've said, and it's kind of reproducible. This is days of symptoms. You know, you have from symptom onset, you have fever for about 12 days. You then have cough for about 18 days. But you can see the shortness of breath begins at gate 7 or 8. And that's when the virus has stopped replicating. You can see how important it is. So the pulmonary phase starts once the virus is replicating. Now you can see it starts on day 8 with shortness of breath. So timing again, it's absolutely critical you start your steroids on day 8. So what we know is if you start steroids late, they've already developed severe inflammatory response. And the train has left the station. They have such, the more you wait, the more intense the inflammatory response becomes. So that's why it's really, timing is so important. Timing, timing, timing. You've got to start your remdesivir if you're going to use it early. But once you reach the pulmonary phase, remdesivir is gone. You've got to start steroids. It's really important. So one of the problems is that people start steroids too late. There was a study recently done in Brazil, which was with steroids, which was negative. It was started on day 13. Can you see where day 13 is? And the patients had been on a ventilator for 3 days already. Why would you do such a thing? So you need to start treatment early. So the next question is, why do some patients do worse? And I think it's a combination of things. I think the viral load. The viral load is very important. The higher the inoculum, the greater viral replication. The higher the viral load, the more viral debris you're going to have and the greater inflammatory response. So the viral load is important, and I'll show you how we can reduce that. Secondly, I think there's some risk factors. Obesity is a terrible risk factor. We know that male sex is a risk factor. Age is a risk factor. So I think there are a number of factors which make it worse. So what's really interesting, women have a much more dampened inflammatory response. So if you look at the cytokines of men versus women, estrogen suppresses macrophage function. So women have much lower cytokine levels. That probably explains why women do better than men. Obesity is a terrible risk factor, particularly in young people. And it's probably because of the increased inflammatory response. So there are some people that do badly, and it's because of this overwhelming inflammatory response. So the first thing is to start steroids early. And if they're not responding, to escalate the dose. Mm. So the problem with the recovery studies is a fixed dose, which I think is wrong. Mm. You know, no two patients are the same. Mm. You would agree with me. So some patients just need a higher dose. So we use methylprednisolone. We start off with a loading dose of 80 and then 40 a day. If the patient's not getting better within 24 hours, we escalate the dose rapidly. Mm. Now, what we found is there are some patients that, despite steroids and vitamin C and all the other goodies we add, the full Monty, really have this overwhelming inflammatory response, which could be part of their genotype and the risk factors. What we do in those patients is we plasma exchange them. So we found that it's a small percentage of patients. We've done maybe 15 to 20 patients who have overwhelming infection, which doesn't seem that we can get under control. Those patients, we do plasma exchange. And remarkably, it seems to work well because you're taking out the bad humors and giving back good humors. So, you know, that is obviously it's not a first line therapy, but in the US, I think, and other countries that can do it, it's something to consider. And there have been increasing reports of the use of plasma exchange. But I think, you know, if you start early, you know, as soon as the patient has respiratory symptoms, they've entered the respiratory phase, that's when you want to hit them with steroids. I think that's so important.
Got it. So I think this is a huge takeaway, even for the whole discussion today. Treat the virus in the viral phase and treat the immune system in the immune phase, and reversing these treatments can actually be fatal for the patient.
Absolutely. So as we'll see, we know from the recovery study, if you use steroids in patients who weren't on oxygen, they did worse. So you're giving steroids when the virus is replicating, it's just going to make the virus replicate more. So that's why you don't want to reverse the order. And I think the same holds for inhaled steroids. It doesn't make sense to give inhaled steroids during the symptomatic phase because you haven't gone to the inflammatory phase yet, and you're just going to promote viral replication. So if you go to the next slide, I think we have this nicely shown. So you know that the symptomatic phase is antiviral therapy. That's what works. Now, you know, whether you use remdesivir or ivermectin or interferon, you know, it doesn't matter. So you can talk about interferon. Interferon likely works early. There's a study with interferon given late and actually may have been harmful because it's an antiviral. So it's very important to distinguish these two phases, the viral replication. And then the virus is stopped. All you have is these trillions of pieces of viral debris. It's the viral debris phase in which you get this profound immune dysregulation. And I think that distinction is so important to appreciate. So using remdesivir at this phase or monoclonal antibodies or a convalescent serum just doesn't make sense. And, you know, you listen to the experts speak and they never talk about this.
And this is what is also interesting. I have seen a few cases in the ICU where as they kept becoming critical, they kept trying to give them more convalescent plasma and more remdesivirs and more of those kind of things. And they would probably be just doing nothing. And even the placebo effect is going to be negative because now we think we are doing something and we are actually
Absolutely
crucial time to actually do something good for the patient.
Yeah, so the problem then is that overwhelming inflammation. These people have profound inflammation. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable how high the CRP and ferritin go. There's no other disease we know that is quite like this. You know, gram-negative sepsis is child's play. You treat it goes away. And I think it's because there's so much viral debris that the host is phagocytosing and responding to. You have overwhelming inflammation. So what you want to do is give anti-inflammatory therapy, you know, steroids, vitamin C, plasma exchange, whatever anti-inflammatory therapies you want to give.
Hmm.
You know, giving, you know, trying to shoot these patients with convalescent serum just does not work.
Got it. Very, very important. So for the cool beans here, if this is clear, I think you have a great takeaway from the discussion today. If this is not clear, as we continue on having more discussions, please rewatch the recorded part in the beginning. The takeaway has to be there is a viral phase and there is an immune dysregulation phase. Treat the virus in the viral phase and treat the immune system in the immune phase. Any imbalance in that management can be fatal.
Got it. If you go to the next slide, I think again, it kind of reinforces this, that you have viral replication, which then decreases. So you have this paradox. As the virus is stopping replicating, you have the marked increase in the inflammatory response. So what you want to do is you want to start treatment early when the patient starts developing pulmonary signs. It's not rocket science, actually. So that's why, you know, you're monitoring the O2 sats is so important. And once patients start developing pulmonary signs, it means they're getting into the severe inflammatory phase, and you have to quell the inflammation. It's like a fire. And the longer you wait to put the fire out, the more destruction the fire has caused and the more difficult to put out the fire.
Makes sense.
Let's go to the next slide, which again shows it again. So this is really, again, important because, you know, people get a PCR and they think that this is active viral replication. So this slide again shows you that the PCR likely is positive for 3 weeks, but the virus has stopped replicating. The other thing that is really important, which people don't recognize, is the false negatives. So if you have a look at the peak, which is on about, again, you know, it's on about day 8 after exposure, only about 80% of people with COVID will be PCR positive. 80%. So we have many patients who have all the features of COVID, and you can test them 6 or 7 times, they remain PCR negative. So COVID is essentially a clinical diagnosis. The PCR is there to help support you. But a negative PCR does not exclude COVID. It's such an important point.
That's a very important thing.
And if you think about it, 20% of people who are negative actually have COVID. And then you can see that the antibody response kind of kicks in once the virus has stopped replicating, obviously indicating that the development of cell-mediated immunity from B cells and T cells. So this, you know, this follows the end of viral replication.
Got it.
So let's go to the next slide. And I think this is, you know, here's the data. So this is the remdesivir study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The first thing that's interesting is this is a preliminary report. We do not have a follow-up report, which is somewhat curious. And I suspect they don't want to give us the follow-up report. Otherwise, if the data was very positive, they would have. The endpoint in this study was not mortality. It was time for resolution of symptoms. And really, that's a very unpatient-centered endpoint. And you can see that the only patients in whom the course was shortened was patients not receiving oxygen. This is from their publication. You can see patients on oxygen or on mechanical ventilation, there was absolutely no difference in any outcome with remdesivir. No outcome.
And the reason is that patient was in the immune dysregulation instead of viral replication phase.
Yes. So, you know what? I mean, I think the data speaks for itself. I think it's absolutely there on the screen, and it's clear and obvious. Remdesivir, which is an antiviral, has no effect once patient has transitioned into the pulmonary phase.
So this is the result showing for the pulmonary phase, and remdesivir is doing nothing. So this idea that as the patient becomes more critical, let's find and give them remdesivir is actually counterproductive.
It makes no sense. It means that people don't understand the disease they're treating. You know, there's the data. There's the data. The data speaks for itself. And the effect of remdesivir is not a mortality reduction. It was a shortening of the duration of symptoms or time to recovery. And most patients want to recover. Whether it takes them 6 days or 8 days, they don't really care. They just want to get better. So you can see the impact of this really expensive drug, really expensive drug, is actually quite marginal.
And I think that not only just that, it is actually counterproductive or destructive as well, because if we think that this is a silver bullet and keep trying to use it in all phases, it is actually going to cause harm because it will not do what we think it will do.
Exactly. You're waiting for something to work that's not going to work, whereas you could be doing something else which would work. So you're using an ineffective therapy and waiting for an ineffective therapy to become effective, and it's not going to work.
Totally makes sense.
Okay, next slide. So now this is the opposite. So this is dexamethasone. Okay, so you can see that this is mortality now. This is mortality. So you can see dexamethasone reduces mortality on patients on a ventilator. It reduces mortality on patients on oxygen. Next slide. However, if you look at patients not on oxygen, it actually, there was a trend towards harm. Do you see that over there?
Yeah.
So it's on the other side, usual care better. So it's very clear again. Corticosteroids are beneficial on ventilation and when you're getting oxygen. But when you're not receiving oxygen, i.e. you don't have pulmonary involvement, there was a trend towards harm, which again fits in exactly with the contextual frame we're developing, that the treatment is very phase specific. You don't want to use steroids in the viral replicative symptomatic phase, and you don't want to use remdesivir in the pulmonary phase. They're not going to work.
Very, very important. And I think this can be the difference in life and death for a patient.
Absolutely. And the treatment is obviously very time sensitive. So the steroids, you want to start exactly at the right time. So that's why timing is so important.
Very interesting.
The next slide was just something we put together because, you know, people are pushing dexamethasone. We much prefer methylprednisolone. So this is a summary of studies using dexamethasone, methylprednisolone, and hydrocortisone. And you can see that the number needed to treat is much less with methylprednisolone than with dexamethasone. So I think this slide shows that clearly. So we strongly recommend the use of methylprednisolone. We recommend a higher dose. And then if the patient has this out of control inflammatory response, you do the logical thing. You just increase the dose because they have a profound inflammatory response.
This is a hugely important data set here that it is showing. For example, if I see here methylprednisone ICU patients, number needed to treat 6.2. And over here, dexamethasone, number needed to treat to save one life, 28.6.
Yes.
This is a huge difference.
And if you actually have a look at the ICU patients, you look at the mortality, 7.2%. You can see how low that is compared to 20% with dexamethasone. So it's real. I mean, this is really making a real difference in mortality. So I think the reason you may have been seeing patients dying is the wrong steroid in the wrong dose given too late and stopped too early.
Well,
so I think steroid is such an important medication in terms of saving lives.
And so it's not just any steroid. The type or the class of steroid is also very important. So methylprednisolone is better than dexamethasone, as we can see here in the data.
Yes. And I think there's really good genomic data to explain that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, firstly, methylprednisolone penetrates much better into the lung, much better. So COVID affects the lung, folks, beans. So, and you want the drug to get to the organ that you want it to influence. So methylprednisolone has much better penetration into the lung than the other steroids. And also it binds differentially to the glucocorticoid receptors and has greater anti-inflammatory effects in patients with SARS.
Got it. So that once again, so cool beans here, the health professionals here, this is the gold standard, in my opinion, for approaching the management of COVID-19 and saving lives. So please check out the kind of medicine to use, the phase of medicine to use, and the urgency of the right medicine to be used at the right time.
Yes, I think you put it, you've articulated it really well. It's urgent, and you have to think about the right medicine at the right time.
Correct. Makes sense. We actually, I'm just going to make a point to the cool beans. I think we have to, so far we've been discussing things with each other, helping protect and save each other and our loved ones. I think we have to take up Math Plus as a mission to spread it to others and bring it to as many people, as many doctors, as many ICUs as we can, and create a bigger impact.
Yeah, now what you're saying is true. You know, when we started pushing steroids, you know, people poo-pooed us and they said what we're doing was wrong, it was harmful. But I think there's now overwhelming evidence. I think there's now overwhelming evidence that corticosteroids save lives, but they save lives in the pulmonary phase.
Makes sense. So tell us a little bit before we go to the next slide.
So the next slide is just a follow-on. So this was actually the Brazilian study I spoke about. So you can see this was a negative study. But why was it negative? They started on day 13. So we can see on day 13, patients had likely had pulmonary symptoms for 5 or 6 days. And it was day 3 on a ventilator. So they should have started much earlier. And then they only treated them for 5 days. So, you know, even if you use the right drug, but you use it in the wrong dose and too late and for too short a period of time, it's not going to work. So therefore, you can see how important timing is. Timing is so important. You want to start at the right time, the right dose, and for the right period of time.
So I think this is very, very important. Right time, right dose, right period of time. So you cannot stop it early. You cannot give the incorrect steroid type. You cannot give the wrong dose. And you cannot start it at the wrong time. These are all, they have to be with precision. And this would only happen when you take interest in your patient, when you want to make sure that you're saving their lives.
Yeah, so I think what you say is so true. You have to think about the patient in front of you. You know, each patient is different. Where are they? What are their risk factors? And where are they in the spectrum or what phase are they in? It's really important.
Makes sense.
So we're going to change gears now. So I get a lot of emails from people who have had COVID 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. And they tell me they have not back to normal. They feel bad. They feel tired. They feel lethargic. And so this is a real syndrome.
And my apologies for interjecting for the cool beans here, because we've been using the term long haulers. This is the long haulers discussion now. Really important. Maybe we can actually take this part of the video's clip and separately publish it as well. So we are talking long haulers now, which Dr. Marek is calling it post-COVID syndrome. Yes, please. My apologies for the interjection.
Yes, no, sure. So These are people that have had COVID, and they could be symptomatic people or patients with pulmonary disease who persist in having symptoms. And, you know, this is a nice table which shows you that post-COVID, so these are people post-COVID, almost 60% have fatigue. They're tired. They're lethargic. They don't have energy. And it affects their quality of life. About 50% have shortness of breath. They have joint pains. They have cough. They have headache. So you can see that there's a vast spectrum of symptoms. So the question is, why do they have all of these symptoms? So nobody has really addressed it, you know. So I can give you some of my speculation, and it's only speculation. So, I mean, I don't have proof. So my theory is that because these patients have such a profound inflammatory response, that these people have ongoing low-level inflammation, which is causing these symptoms. So we know in patients who have gram-negative sepsis, that if you look at their cytokine profile 1 year after the episode, they still have elevated levels of pro-inflammatory cytokines, which is what is causing all of these symptoms. So my theory is that perhaps they weren't treated with steroids appropriately up front, or the steroids were stopped too quickly. So my first recommendation is to check the CRP. And I think if the CRP is elevated, this means that the patients still have ongoing inflammation.
And this is such an important thing. Once again, my apologies for the interjection here. I have some patients who have gone in long hauling state or in the post-COVID-19 syndrome, as you're saying. What I saw was that when the young ones, if I use steroids, I use Delta Cortral with them, they very quickly recover. However, those patients who may have comorbidities or who may have other inflammations going on, this is what I've observed. For example, one of my patients had an arm surgery before he developed COVID. Excuse me. And since the COVID, he has recovered from COVID, but that surgery where the inflammation was going on is now sticking there. The inflammation is sticking there for 2.5 months. So it looks like they get stuck in the inflammatory state and it doesn't go away.
Yeah. So I think there are a few tricks. So we have a few tricks on our sleeve on how to deal with this inflammation. So you can see the way we deal with the inflammation now is somewhat different when they're in ICU. I mean, it kind of makes sense. It's a different kind of a problem. So we'll come to what we do. The other thing that these people have is they have a high risk of clotting. Both DVTs and PEs and strokes and all kinds of things. They have a high risk of clotting. So what we suggest is that on discharge, you measure their D-dimer. You look at their age. You risk stratify them. And there is a place for extended thromboprophylaxis.
So I want to open up here.
Yeah, there we go. So patients have an increased risk of thromboembolic events after discharge. So you need to think of extended thromboprophylaxis. And I think this is the place that NOAC or DOAC may have a role because it's much easier. So, you know, patients who on discharge have a high D dimer. Interestingly enough, CRP increases your risk of clotting. If your age is more than 60 and you've had prolonged immobilization, which applies to most COVIDs, these people are at a really high risk of developing thrombotic events. And I think it's a disaster when the patient goes home and comes back 2 days later with a massive PE. So I think this is really an important aspect which we've now identified.
This is really important. Yes, please.
Yeah, so I think patients need to be risk stratified on discharge. Do they need a DOAC? And for how long? You know, I would say at least 4 weeks, but I think it has to be considered. We then go to the post-COVID syndrome that we spoke about. So we have a few new little tricks. So apart from the steroid, I think that omega-3 fatty acids are really important, because omega-3 fatty acids, part of their metabolic products are things called resolvins and protectins. And these are lipid products that actually enhance healing. So these are breakdown products from omega-3 fatty acids that promote healing and resolution of inflammation. The molecules are called resolvins, and they're byproducts of omega-3 fatty acids. So I would give these people omega-3 fatty acids. The other thing which is interesting is statins increase resolvin synthesis. So you use a statin plus omega-3s, it may work in combination. Now, obviously, you know, what I'm telling you now is, you know, just makes basic sense. I think it's probably safe. It's intuitively obvious. I have no data to support this.
Got it.
You know, when you're faced with a situation of patients who are suffering, you can't just let them be. You have to do something. So you want to do something that is safe and is potentially helpful. So I think, you know, you would consider a short course of steroids with omega-3s and atorvastatin. Obviously, I would continue the melatonin and their B vitamins, particularly, you know, so I would recommend a, you know, B complex and vitamin D.
I love it. So my own experience from outpatient, you know, long haulers, Delta Cortril has been very, very successful. But in a couple of cases where it did not do the job right away, I am actually going to try these as well.
Yeah, I think you have nothing to lose.
Yes.
The other thing that is truly astonishing and completely disturbing and very worrisome, there was a study which did MRIs 3 or 4 weeks after patients were discharged. And 50% of patients had evidence of MRI of dysfunction, microinfarcts, and MRI abnormalities. So, you know, the COVID is a very serious disease. This is not the flu. And I think, you know, we think of the acute events, but this disease has long-term consequences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So tell me this, pulmonary fibrosis, is there some real good management for pulmonary fibrosis?
So we don't know. So this was, you know, there are some patients, you know, if you start late, who are going to get severe pulmonary fibrosis. So a few people have, you know, we do have pulmonologists have antifibrotic agents that we use for, you know, interstitial fibrosis. So I think that if patients do have evidence of pulmonary fibrosis, they should be referred to a pulmonologist who can then, because this is quite complicated medicine. There are a number of antifibrotics that may be of benefit. So I think it's worthwhile trying. But I think, you know, the general practitioners, internists, shouldn't be doing this. They need to be referred to a pulmonologist.
Got it. And for the cool beans here, cool beans, I have the link to this document. This is Math Plus Protocol updated on 2nd September, and the link is in the description. Dr. Marek, would you like to talk a little bit about the masks as well?
Yes. And so, you know, I think this has become such an important issue. So, you know, and I think people take it for granted. So there was a really interesting study. What they did is they looked at people breathing. People just breathing, like you and I and everyone else is doing now. They were not coughing. They were not speaking. They were not sneezing. They were not exhaling. They were just breathing. And they measured the condensate. The condensate in someone who is breathing contains over 1 billion viruses.
Oh, wow.
Billion.
So if we have a mirror in front of me while I'm breathing, that condensation that would be there can have more than a billion viruses in it.
Yes.
Wow.
So you know what? I think it tells us how infectious this disease is. It tells us how rapidly this virus replicates in the upper airways. So it's this is completely different to the flu. This is why it's so contagious, why it spreads so quickly, and that the higher the viral load, the worse the disease.
Got it.
So there is absolutely no question of doubt. The only way to control this pandemic is for universal masking. You know, it's not a political thing. It's just common sense. The only way we're going to control this is by wearing a mask. The interesting thing about wearing a mask is it doesn't only protect other people, it actually protects the wearer. Because what happens is if you wear a mask, obviously it's not an N95, so it doesn't stop all viruses, but it significantly decreases the viral load. So if you wear a mask, you're much, much more likely to have an asymptomatic infection than a symptomatic infection.
I love it. So can I?
And you go to the next slide, and I'll show you a really interesting observation. So this is called the Tale of Two Cruises. So as you know, the Diamond Princess was the ship stuck off the coast of Japan.
Yeah.
It was the first ship. Nobody wore masks. When they tested the people, about 20% of all the infections were asymptomatic. The rest were all symptomatic. There was an Argentinian ship that went to the Antarctic. It was another cruise ship that had an outbreak. But what happened on this ship is every single person was forced to wear a mask. When they tested them, 81% of the infections were asymptomatic. There were far, far fewer symptomatic, but most of them were asymptomatic. So it's telling you, if you wear a mask, you have a decreased viral load. The viral load or inoculum size is one of the most critical factors in determining the outcome of the disease. Because the higher the viral load, the more it replicates, and then once you kill the virus, the more viral debris you have. So wearing a mask protects you as well as your fellow citizens. So I think, you know, the question of masks is no longer a question.
So this is a very important point here. Even this morning, I was speaking with someone from Tunisia, and he was conjecturing, he was hypothesizing, he was saying, He feels that if the initial load of the virus is less, then our immune response is less as well, and we recover with milder symptoms compared to becoming severe. And if the initial loads are high and the replication has really been great, then we go into those dysregulated and severe cases. And that is, I think, what you are talking about here as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question. So the viral load is so important. The higher the load, the more viruses you have, the more inflammation you have. So you want to try and decrease your viral load and try and prevent transmission.
So then can I paraphrase this way, that if the cool beans here, if we wear masks and kind of reduce the amount of exposure, then it is possible that even if we get it, we would actually get out of it with lesser price to pay, maybe asymptomatically or with lesser symptoms compared to becoming aggravated and in the ICUs. It is possible. There is a potential.
I think absolutely. And the other thing people forget is, you know, when we get a vaccine, if we ever do get a vaccine, and that's if we do, it's not going to be 100% effective. It may be 70%. So we still need to wear masks because it's still going to be circulating. So we stuck with masks whether we like it or not. I think we just got to get used to them. We have to accept it, that this is the only way we're going to control the pandemic. This is not some kind of a hoax. It's not fake news. It's real. And I think people just have to be responsible and wear masks. I think I can't see any other option.
Makes sense. Makes sense. So, Dr. Marek, we have you are on the East Coast. It is about 10 o'clock on your side. Is it okay if I can ask you a few questions that folks had been asking?
Sure.
So just a few questions and then we can break. So I'm going to just scroll over these questions and see. Apologies. There were lots of questions that have. So there is a question about timing of melatonin.
Yes. So, you know, I think we know there's a good study that shows people who took melatonin were at a lower risk of developing COVID. I think there's some data that melatonin decreases the severity of COVID. Hmm. So I think that everybody should be taking melatonin. Hmm. You know, it's really cheap.
Hmm.
And the worst that can happen is you can have a good night's sleep. So I think in terms of prophylaxis, I think it's a good thing. And then obviously once patients become symptomatic, maybe they increase the dose. You know, it's so completely safe. It's so completely safe. Some people may have bad dreams, and that's because of hyper-REM sleep. All you then do is you decrease the dose somewhat.
Perfect.
And I do recommend slow release because it gives you a much more normal melatonin pattern.
Got it. Next question. Should we wear goggles?
You know what? I think there's one or two cases of a patient spitting in a person's eye and transmitting COVID. So, you know, we have to live in the real world. You know, I think if you in the ICU, you're doing a procedure, then okay, you can wear goggles. But I think to wear goggles otherwise, I think is cumbersome. The main route of transmission is droplet spread. There is some airborne spread. Most of it is droplet spread. So I think masks are so important. Maybe in certain circumstances, when you have direct contact with patients, wearing goggles is okay, particularly if you don't have glasses. But I think the most important is masks.
Got it.
In terms of fish oil, so, you know, I'm humans evolved on a diet much higher in omega-3s than omega-6s. You know, our Western diet is really bad. And I really believe that omega-3s have anti-inflammatory properties, are good for platelets, good for blood vessels. So, you know, I would take them prophylactically. I would take them when the patient is sick. And obviously in the post-COVID syndrome, I think it's very important. So much like melatonin, it's really safe.
Yes.
And I think it can be helpful.
Absolutely. Got it. Couple of questions. Who is developing COVID syndrome? Those hospitalized with serious symptoms only, meaning who is prone to this syndrome?
Yes. So no, you know what? I mean, we have a respiratory therapist who got COVID who is at home. And speaking to her, she was never that sick. She never came to hospital. She is suffering. She is really fatigued and tired. And I get a lot of emails from people who are treated at home. So I think it's people who've been in hospital, but also, you know, symptomatic patients who treated at home have the syndrome.
And I think
these people are obviously less likely to have had received steroids. Yes. So, you know, it's a really real syndrome and patients suffer.
And I have seen it. I have seen mostly outpatient. And I have seen in many of my outpatient patients that they develop long haul syndrome. Fortunately, all of my long haulers have become recovered. There is just one person who did not respond that fast to the first pulse of the steroids. And I'm going to try now Omega and the other statins as well. So two more questions. So here is a question. What can you do for inflammation without prescription meds? Most long haulers have no doctor care.
Okay, well, you know, I think, you know, omega-3 fatty acids you can get from the pharmacy. melatonin you can get from the pharmacy. You know, obviously, you know, the steroids and statins, you do need a prescription, unfortunately. So, you know, I think you've got to contact the Great Bean and he will express you some medications. You know, unfortunately, I mean, we live in a strange world. I think, you know, you need these people should be followed by their primary care doctor because there may be other issues as well. And, you know, I think the primary care doctor can help them. But obviously, you know, if you're limited, you know, I would say, you know, use omega-3s, vitamin C, quercetin, you know, whatever you can get hold of.
Got it. And the final question, of course, there are a lot more questions as well over here. We will try to get back with those questions another time too. One question, the ascorbic acid that you say, so this is from James Kelly. I had mentioned that question before as well. He's wondering that the ascorbic acid that you have in the MathPlus protocol, who is the manufacturer of it? Or do you know the brand or some more details?
So in the US, there two formulations which are generally used, two readily available formulations that are approved. The one is made by McGuff Pharmaceuticals called Ascor. The other one is by Mylan Pharmaceuticals and it's ascorbic acid. Those are the only two commercially available vitamin C preparations. Both of them are sodium ascorbate. And both of them do have some sodium bicarbonate for buffering. So the question was, you know, the viewer was asking, can you get pure ascorbic acid without sodium? And it seems the answer is no, that the formulations available in the U.S. are sodium ascorbate, which then obviously when you inject it will dissociate into sodium and the ascorbate ion. Whether it makes a difference or not, I can't tell you. But unfortunately, those are the only formulations available in the U.S.
Got it.
So I saw a question about the dose of melatonin.
Yes.
And maybe I should answer that because it's kind of interesting. There's enormous difference in bioavailability between different people. So melatonin undergoes first pass effect through the liver. So some people are rapid metabolizers and others are slow metabolizers. And it's difficult to know. So the recommended dose is about 2 milligrams at night. But some people actually can go higher and other people can go lower. So a reasonable dose is 2 milligrams of slow release at night. I take 1 milligram because if I take a higher dose, I get really bad REM dreams. So I think you have to individualize it and see what works best for you. You know, I wouldn't go higher than 10 milligrams. That doesn't make sense. So, you know, I would start off at, you know, maybe 2 and see what happens.
Got it. And two questions, a little more to your practice and to you. So number one, do you take any prophylaxis? Do you take any supplements? How do you keep yourself protected and healthy?
Yes. So I take vitamin C, quercetin, melatonin, omega-3s every day.
Got it. And then the last question, do you test every one of your patients for vitamin D3 levels?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I think it would be worthwhile doing that. So I think we know what kind of patients are going to be vitamin D deficient. You know, if you're elderly, if you or a person of color, if you're obese, you're likely to have low vitamin D levels. And also if you spend the time indoors. So, you know, if you spend no time outdoors. So I think, you know, what I would say is, you know, taking 2,000 units of vitamin D daily is pretty safe. But if you think you're at a high risk of having really low levels. So, you know, you don't get out a lot. You may be elderly. It may be worthwhile checking a vitamin D level.
Absolutely. Makes sense. So Dr. Marek, thank you so much. You are actually our king bean, although you call yourself a soybean, but you are a king bean. Thank you very much for being with us. And this has been such, I think just this talk is sufficient for the healthcare professionals to know how to manage their patients.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to thank you because I think you're doing a great service. I think it's great for people to talk about this disease. And I think we need to educate people. You know, this is a complicated disease, and I think people need to understand the disease. You can't treat something you don't understand. So people need to think about it, and we need to spread the word. And I think you're doing a wonderful job.
Perfect. Thank you very much. I am very, very honored to have you. We Cool Beans are honored to have you. And Cool Beans, I think we should take this as a mission, as a collective mission, to make sure that we spread the Math Plus protocol to as many as possible. This would not only save lives, I think this is the time to serve. So please join me, join Dr. Marek as well. Let us take this as our mission from this platform.
Yeah, and just to finish off, Dr. Bean, I actually got an email 2 days ago from a gentleman in some distant part in India. He says he lives in a very impoverished part of India. He doesn't have access to expensive medicines. He said he's been using the Math Plus protocol, and he thanked me because he thinks it saved hundreds of lives. So, you know, that did give me some kind of, you know, satisfaction that, you know, people are listening, and if, you know, you care, you can make a difference.
Absolutely. And I think, and I say it many, many times, there are people at this time as well who are looking for cash grabs and the brand positions and everything. This is the time globally for the human race to try to rescue ourselves, help each other. Then we can go back to earning monies and we can go back to being whatever we want to be. This is the time to serve each other and help each other. So thank you very much. Please like, subscribe, and share. Please share it to 2 or 3 people. Ask them to share it further, especially give it to the folks who are managing patients, doctors, and the ICU doctors. This would really be a favor from you. Dr. Marek, once again, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Bean.